Of four lessons that we have entitled Searching for Happiness. It is a study wherein we're looking for what is the answer for being happy as God would have us to be. We started pursuing such questions as, is happiness something that just happens to me? Is it that I'm not happy because it just didn't come my way? And if that's something that I have to find, then where can I find happiness? And if you say it's found in Christianity, then why am I not happy, you may ask. And why is it that so many people are unhappy? In fact, why are so many people miserable, in fact? We began our studies by defining happiness. Let's look again at our definition of happiness. Dr. Maxwell Maltz said that happiness is the state of mind or habit where we have more pleasant thoughts, or pleasant thoughts the greater part of the time. Merriam-Webster defined it as being the state of well-being and contentment or joy. That's what we're talking about when we talk about happiness. This is our third study. Let's review what we saw in our first two, particularly for the benefit of those who were not with us. In our first study, we talked about how that everybody is searching for happiness. Everybody wants it. It's a universal quest. Jesus is the answer because he came to bring happiness, as we saw in the Sermon on the Mount beginning at chapter 5. We'll say more about that a little bit later. We concluded that study by talking about how that we have to go after it and seek it. And there were three things that we talked about. That we have to make up our mind, number one, to be happy. Number two, we have to make sure that our thoughts are happy ones. And thirdly, start counting your blessings and be thankful. And that leads to happiness. That led us to talk in the second study about these five principles. These are also part of those keys to seeking after happiness. That is, number one, you talk about things that are happy people, that is, being happy people, you act like you're happy. You try to be what God would have you to be. Secondly, concentrate on solutions rather than the problems. Thirdly, we talked about how that you take a look from the outside, look at your life from the other side, and not just from the inside. Define life's purpose, then locate and focus the center of life and focus upon that. That is, Christ being the center. Let's continue our search for happiness, and let's talk about how we need to conduct our life in harmony with the will of God. That's simple enough. And yet that's a fundamental principle for being a happy person. Conduct your life in harmony with the will of God. There are people who think that religion is the source of misery. Consider Karl Marx, who made this statement. He said the first requisite for happiness is abolition of religion. If you want to be happy, you've got to get rid of religion because that is the source of misery for people. Most of us recognize that counselors, much like preachers, are most of them don't know what they're doing. And what I mean by that, many counselors are those who point to religion as the source of your guilt and misery. You're having problems and you're suffering from depression and you go to a counselor and you say, I've got to have some help. And one of the first things they may focus on is, it's your religion that's causing your guilt. And that's causing your misery. That's why you feel the way that you do. That's why you're having the difficulties in your marriage that you're having. You need to get rid of your religion and then you'll be a happy person. There are many who think that religion is the source of our misery. Actually, it's the opposite that is true. And I want us to establish that principle. Much of the unhappiness in the world is brought on because we either ignore God's will or we deliberately violate God's will. And that's a source of our unhappiness. That may be true either directly or indirectly. Meaning by that, it may be that I'm doing something contrary to the will of God and that directly causes me to be unhappy. Or it may be that I'm doing something contrary to the will of God, and that causes a problem, which causes something else, which then causes me to be unhappy. Let's consider some examples of that. Let's talk about how that bad behavior often leads to misery and pain. Bad behavior often leads to misery and pain. In our own lives, every one of us have seen careless decisions that we've made, and we suffer because of it. It may just be a slight misjudgment that we had, and we paid the price for that. It might be that we bought something we really didn't need and consequently now we've got to pay for it and now we suffer because of our bad judgment. Or it may have been something major and we dearly paid the price for that. In other words, we suffered because of our bad behavior. One of the great cases in point would be that of drinking alcohol. Someone who drinks alcohol begins to destroy their body. It may begin with the destroying of their brain cells. It may be the destruction of their liver, the deterioration of the pancreas, and on down the line with various problems they have. The problems that they now have lead to misery, and this person then becomes one of the most unhappy people on earth. Started with something they thought would make them happy, but because they're doing something contrary to the will of God, it is a sin. 1 Peter chapter 4 and in verse 3, we're not to be drinking. Drunkenness is condemned in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Because they violated the basic principle of God's will, now they're unhappy and they're miserable. I don't want to suggest to you there are other sins that lead to a miserable life. For example, it may be drugs and substance abuse. How many people have you known that have got involved in drugs and substance abuse that seem to be real happy people? They're constantly happy. It leads to misery. It's divorce. It might be the problem with fornication, or it might be of lying. It might be the premarital relationship that caused a problem of some disease that they now have, or it might be an unwanted pregnancy that now has caused some frustrations. Or it may have led to divorce and the ending of the marriage relationship. What I'm trying to suggest is bad behavior often brings pain and suffering and causes us to be unhappy. What sin does is it destroys us spiritually, separates us from God. Let's go back to a familiar passage in the book of Isaiah. Let's establish the principle that sin, anytime sin enters our life, it's going to cause some problems and it destroys us spiritually. Isaiah 59 and verse 2, your sins have separated you and your God. It is your sins that separate you from God. You remember Romans chapter 6 and verse 23, the wages of sin is death. Here is the dire consequence because of engaging in sin. It causes a separation from God. And consequently, that brings misery. What sin does is it destroys our character. It ruins our reputation. You remember the principle, the general principle of Galatians 6 and in verse 7, we reap what we sow. Whatever man sows, that will he also reap. That's a general principle. You sow in your garden, that's what you're going to reap. You sow problems and destruction in your life, you're going to reap the destruction in your life. Do you remember God called upon Israel to repent, Ezekiel 18 and in verse 30, because your transgression and your iniquity will cause your ruin, he said. Iniquity causes ruin. It causes destruction. It destroys our character. It weakens our defense. It devastates our sense of self-worth. So here is a person doing things they know to be wrong. It's destroying them spiritually. If they have any semblance of spirituality, that causes misery because it's destroying their self-worth. It weakens their defense. It destroys their character. And they know that it separates them from God. So here's the principle. Live your life by the will of God, and it's going to bring about happiness. Let's turn to Philippians chapter 1 and in verse 27. Now, what's the significance of Philippians chapter 1? This is that book we've talked about several times that, coupled with the commitment toward Christ, is an overriding or an underwriting theme, however you view that, of joy and rejoicing, happiness. Notice chapter 3 and in verse 1, rejoice in the Lord. Chapter 4 and verse 4, rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. Now, let's go back to chapter 1 and verse 27. One of the key principles to have that joy and that happiness is this commitment to behave yourself and guide your life by the will of God. Look at verse 27. Only let your conduct, King James says your conversation, that's your manner of life, be worthy of the gospel of Christ. In other words, put it in harmony with the will of Christ. Live your life as it becomes the gospel of Christ. There's a Cherokee proverb that says, when you were born, you cried and the world rejoiced. Live your life so that when you die, the world cries and you rejoice. Pretty good thought, isn't it? Live your life so that when you die, you'll be rejoicing, that you're in harmony with the will of God. Here's the point. The point is, happiness will always elude us if we're trying to ignore the will of God. There are people who are shunning the will of God. They push the will of God aside, and then they wonder, why am I miserable? Why am I not happy? You want to be happy? Then conform your life to the will of God, and that brings happiness, as we saw in Matthew chapter 5. Here's the second principle. You want to be a happy person? You're searching for happiness, lose yourself in service to God and in service to others. Lose yourself in service to God and in service unto other people. That leads to happiness. Unhappiness and misery are easy destinations. Happiness may not be quite as easy because you have to search for it. But misery and unhappiness is quite an easy destination. We can all get there very effortless. It doesn't take much effort to decide, you know what, I think I want to be miserable and I want to be unhappy and I'm going to set out to do that. It doesn't take long to get there. All you have to do is follow the simple recipe. How so? Well, think constantly about yourself. Think constantly about yourself. Talk incessantly about yourself. Make sure all your conversations come back to you. You're always talking about yourself. Use the word I as much as possible. Don't talk about other people and what you can do for others. Focus on yourself. Fourthly, mirror yourself continually in the opinion of others. Always worry about how you're viewed in the eyes of others. Always worry how you're looked in the eyes of other people. Always be concerned with that. And then furthermore, listen to what other people say about you, and then always, always expect to be appreciated. You follow those rules, and that'll lead you to misery every time. You know anybody that follows those rules? They always talk about themselves. Always talking about I. Constantly speaking about themselves, listening and concerned about what others think, and always expect to be appreciated, and they become the most unhappy and the most miserable people. You say you want to be happy? Well, then follow the biblical principle because it gives a different emphasis on self. Let's turn to Romans chapter 12, if you will, and in verse 3. Romans 12 is that chapter that talks about relationships, as you well know. And it's interesting that he talks about our view of ourselves at the beginning of our relationships. You have a relationship with other people, and one of the things that's going to be key to having a good relationship with other people is having a proper view of self. Look at verse 3. He said, "For I say, through the grace of given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to everyone the measure of faith." Well, that calls for a balanced view, I call it. How so? Well, he said, don't inflate and think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, as if you are the center of all things. And everything concerns about whether or not you are appreciated and whether or not you are noticed and whether or not everything concerns you. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. But then to think soberly as God has dealt to every man the measure of faith. Don't put yourself down either. Don't have a self-deflating thing so that you put yourself down below the estimation that God has for you. In other words, it calls for a balanced view of yourself. And that leads to happiness. But here's another principle. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. There was a problem at Corinth. There was some bickering going on. And the text indicates, perhaps pointing to chapter 12, I think. And when I come to chapter 4, I always think he's pointing to the things of chapter 12. But he notice what he says, that these things, brethren, I have in a figure transferred to myself and Apollos for your sake, that you may learn not to think beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up on behalf of one against another. Puffed up one against the other. What's that talking about? Well, I can't help but think of chapter 12 where one thinks, you know what, I have a gift that you don't have, and that makes me better and superior to you. Mine is the most important gift. Mine is the one that everybody envies. Mine is the one that everybody wants. I have the most important gift. Don't be puffed up one against the other. Don't think of yourselves as being better than others, is his point. Don't just focus on yourself. Philippians chapter 2 and in verse 4. This is in the context of unity and harmony and humility. All of those are mentioned in the context of Philippians chapter 2. He said, look not each man upon his own things only, but also upon the interest of others. You want to be happy? By the way, that's Philippians, where he talks about rejoice in the Lord, happiness all through the book. The underlying principle in the book. And commitment to Christ. And in that context, he says, chapter 2, don't just think about yourself, think about others as well. Pride is often driven by jealousy. That is, this inflated view of oneself, who focuses only on self, is often driven by jealousy. That person is self-absorbed and they're only thinking of themselves, and thus they become insecure. Consequently, out of envy of success of others, our arrogant actions cover our insecurities. You ever notice someone who comes across as quite arrogant and inflated in their view of themselves is actually covering for their own insecurities and their feeling of inadequacy? And they overcompensate by having kind of this prideful concept and arrogant feeling about themselves. And that's driven because they're focusing only upon themselves. Here's the point. The point is that those who think so much of themselves are not really happy people. The more we concentrate on thinking about our own situation, the greater our unhappiness. Have you ever talked to someone that you just recognize they always seem to be unhappy? And that when you talk to them, their conversation centers around themselves. Well, they may talk about other people, but it's because of what other people have either done to them or have not done for them. Their focus is on themselves. And they become most unhappy. The key to happiness is the focus upon God and upon other people. I like what Barry said. He said, those who bring sunshine into the lives of others cannot keep it from themselves. If you're about the task of bringing happiness to other people and sunshine to the lives of other people, you're going to end up bringing a little bit to yourself. Here's the key that Jesus gave in Acts chapter 20 and verse 35. Jesus is quoted by Paul, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." We like to receive, that's the focus on self. Giving is the focus on others. Jesus said that's far more blessed to give than to receive. Do you remember these passages? We'll just notice one of these. Turn to Matthew, the 20th chapter, if you will. The text says, concerning the work of Jesus and his mission on earth, Matthew 20. Notice in verse 28, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. The mission of Jesus was he came not that someone might serve him, but that he might be a servant to other people. We're to follow in his steps. 1 Peter chapter 2 and in verse 21. First and foremost, John 4 said he came to do the will of his Father. That is, he absorbed his life in doing the will of God. So if I follow the example of Jesus, what he taught me was that he submersed himself in doing the will of the Father, number one. Number two, he came to serve other people, and he said it was more blessed to give than to receive. Taught me a lesson concerning happiness. Lose yourself in service unto others, and consequently, you become the happy person. So you want to be happy? Say, I'd love to be happy. Well, then focus on what you can do for others, and that leads to happiness. Jesus taught us so. Here's a third principle. You say you want to be happy, and you're searching for happiness. Take pleasure in the simple things of life. Take pleasure in the simplest of things. One of the reasons many people are not happy is that they're looking for big slices of happiness. When little bits of happiness are all around us. Have you thought about that? Sometimes when somebody is not happy and they describe, I tell you what would make me happy, they describe something that's going to be a big slice of life. And if they have the big slices of happiness, then they're going to be happy people. When there's little slices and little bits of happiness all around us, Benjamin Franklin said this, human felicity, that's happiness, is produced not so much by great pieces of good fortune that seldom happen, but by little advantages that occur every day. Maybe if I'm not looking, I'm not happy and I'm looking for happiness, I'm looking for some great big change in life. When all around me are little bitty things that contribute to my happiness. Jonathan Stuart Mill said, I have learned to seek my happiness by limiting my desires rather than attempting to satisfy them. Have you thought about that principle? Well, let's look at Ecclesiastes 1 and see if that doesn't fit with that principle. Remember, Solomon set out on this course of what makes man what he ought to be and what makes man happy. And that's really what the book of Ecclesiastes is all about. So chapter 1, he starts on this note. And in verse 8, he says that all things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. And then he says, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. There's nothing in life that fully satisfies man, is his point. And life is filled with boredom and frustration and guilt. And he said, we're never completely satisfied, making the same point that Mill just made. That if I have these great big desires, and if I could just have this big piece of life, I would be happy. Then I'll never really be happy because the eye's never satisfied. You've heard the story of the man who walked everywhere he went barefooted, and he thought when he saw some man coming down beside him who had a pair of shoes, that if I just had a pair of shoes, I wouldn't complain about anything else. I would be happy if I just had a pair of shoes. And he got him a pair of shoes, and he began to walk, and he said, I tell you what, though, when I see that man on the bicycle, I'd be happy if I just had a bicycle. I wouldn't care about having a car. I just want a bicycle. It'd be a whole lot easier to get around if I had a bicycle. And he was satisfied until he saw some man on a motorcycle, and he said, I don't care about a car. I just want something where I don't have to pedal, and I would be happy if. And then he got him a motorcycle, and then he was only happy a little while until he saw somebody in a very small car. I don't want a big car, but if I just had a car where I could get out of the rain and out of the weather, I would be happy. And then once he got a car, he wanted a bigger car, and you know how the story goes on. And quite often we're like that. As Mill suggests here, the eye is never satisfied. And if we're attempting to satisfy those big pieces of life, then we never will be satisfied, as the writer of the book of Ecclesiastes so well expressed. And if we allow our minds to run wild, we'll never be able to satisfy all those outlandish concepts that we want to fulfill. The simple things in life bring pleasure in life. Have you thought about how some of the simplest things, like just a cold drink of water? When you're hot and you're thirsty and you've been working, there's no real satisfaction that you've got money in your pocket, or that you've got a nice car, or you've got a big house. That doesn't satisfy your thirst like just a cold drink of water. Have you thought about how your favorite food, it doesn't have to be expensive, whatever that may be, brings happiness? Or maybe it's a pet. Or maybe it's the seeing of a loved one this time of year that you haven't seen in a while, and the fact that they just come and show up and you spend a day or two with them brings happiness. The simplest of things. Or maybe it's a drive through the countryside, or that feeling of accomplishment when you finished a difficult task. Here's the point. Many of the simplest things in life prove to be the very things that make life so enjoyable and that makes us happy. It's not the big slices of life. It's the simple things in life. You see, the more complicated and the more sophisticated our desires become, the more difficult it is to satisfy those desires. Turn back with me to Ecclesiastes chapter 2, if you will. There, in the same book that we were embarking upon a few moments ago. Notice chapter 2 now and in verse 24. Chapter 2 and in verse 24, I want us to see that the simple blessings are among God's greatest gifts. The simple fundamental things of life are among the greatest gifts. He said there is nothing better for a man than he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy the good and his labor. This I saw is from the hand of God. Well, there are a number of things I learned from that, but I learned this basic principle. The simple blessings are among God's greatest gifts. The simple little things that make life so enjoyable, that make you enjoy life and therefore make you indeed happy. Let's go to the third chapter, same book, verses 11 to 13. Notice beginning at verse 11, chapter 3, he said, he has made everything beautiful in his time. Also, he's put eternity in the hearts. Except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. I know there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in their lives. Again, a number of things I learned from that. One of which is doing well in the things you consider to be important, whatever that is, brings happiness. You deem it important to be serving God and you do well in that, that brings happiness. If you deem it important to give emphasis to family and you do well in that, that brings happiness. You think it's well to give emphasis to friendships and you do well in that, that brings happiness. The simple things of life bring about happiness. Even work itself brings pleasure. Colossians chapter 3, let's turn there for a moment. Even work itself can bring a certain degree of pleasure and satisfaction, and therefore it brings happiness. Colossians chapter 3, he's speaking of those who would be slaves, as we would think of them, workers for others. And he says in chapter 3 and in verse 23, that to these servants, whatever you do, do it heartily as to the Lord. Can you imagine a slave being happy with his work? And yet what the text is saying is, you approach that job like you're working for the Lord, and when you've done a good job at doing that, you've done a good job for the Lord, and therefore you are thus satisfied. And even our jobs can bring happiness. Thomas Jefferson once wrote in a letter saying, it is neither wealth nor splendor, but tranquility and occupation which give happiness. Not the amount of wealth you have. Confucius said, choose a job you like and you'll never have to work a day in your life. Ever feel that way when you really enjoy your work and you get yourself into your work and you work hard at it and you accomplish something and you feel good about that and it brings happiness because you're enjoying what you do? Doesn't feel like you're working a day in your life. The architect of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, as they were building the building, walked through the yard where the workers were working and he asked them a simple question. What are you doing? And he came to one worker and he said, what are you doing? And his answer was, I'm laying stones. He went to the second worker and he said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm earning a living for my wife and for my children. Working for my family. And he came to the third one and he asked, what are you doing? And he said, I'm building a cathedral. And finally one had the answer that encompassed what everybody else was doing. He was involved in something bigger than himself. When we have that concept about our jobs and our work, that satisfaction brings happiness. Here's a fourth principle. You say you want to be happy, and you're searching for happiness, don't borrow trouble from tomorrow. Don't borrow trouble from tomorrow. Worry has a tendency to breed pessimism. One writer said, if it weren't for the optimist, the pessimist wouldn't know how happy he isn't. Isn't that true? And another writer said concerning the pessimist that he feels bad when he feels good for fear that he'll feel worse when he feels better. How true. You ever see people who have that concept that everything is bad, everything is negative, there is nothing positive, and consequently that leads to their misery. Now let's look at the context of two passages we've considered already. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 6. And what I want you to see is that implied in the context is that worry and looking at the worst and the darkest side of things go hand in hand. Let's turn to Matthew chapter 6. This is in that Sermon on the Mount, which, by the way, follows on the heels of Jesus saying in chapter 5, happy is the one, happy is this one, and happy is that one. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Happy are the poor in spirit, in other words. In the sermon that deals with happiness, notice in chapter 6, beginning at verse 24, or verse 25, he said, therefore, I say to you, do not worry about your life. Here's that anxiety and that worry. Don't worry about your life, he said. What was he talking about? Well, let's read a little bit further. What you will drink, or about your body, what you'll put on, is not life more than food, and body than clothing? The birds of the air, they neither sow nor reap, and they get, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are they not more value than they? What's he talking about? People worrying about their food and their clothing. What are we going to have to eat tomorrow? Reckon we'll have enough to eat? Reckon God will provide for us? Reckon we'll have enough? What are we going to do? What are we going to do about clothes? He said, God takes care of them, and they don't worry. Why won't he take care of you? The point is, they're looking at the worst possible scenario, and thus they're worrying. They're pessimists, and they worry. Let's go to Philippians 4 and see if that's not the same point in Philippians chapter 4. I'm trying to establish that worry and looking at the worst and the darkest side go hand in hand. Pessimism and worry go hand in hand. Look at Philippians chapter 4, if you will. This is another passage that talks about worry. Again, in the context of rejoicing, chapter 3, verse 1, chapter 4, and in verse 4. In that context, he said in chapter 4, in verse 6, he said, do not worry about anything whatsoever, one translation says, or be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, let your requests be made known unto God. And then he turns at verse 8 about looking at the brighter side of things. But now notice two things. There's the brighter side of verse 8 in contrast to the worry of verse 6. There's the worry in contrast to turning all your cares over to God, verse 6 in prayer. Both imply that worry means you're looking at the darker side of things. It's a pessimistic concept of life. Have you stopped to realize that the pessimists are quite often wrong? And most of what we worry about never happens anyway. And most of those who say something is not going to be done and can't be done, it never turns out to be like the pessimist said. Do you realize that when the railroads were introduced in the United States, one authority said that the sight of a rushing locomotive through the countryside would drive people insane, and we're going to have to build more insane asylums because we now have the locomotives. Kind of a pessimistic view of progress that was being made. He was wrong. In Germany, they said that if the train were to get such high speeds as 15 miles an hour, that will cause blood to gush from the nose and cause the person to suffocate if they go through a tunnel. Kind of a pessimistic view. They were wrong. Joshua Copperfield was arrested in Boston because he was selling stock in this new invention called a telephone, because everyone knows, they said, you'll never be able to transmit a voice over a wire. They were pessimists, and they were wrong. There was a Michigan banker that talked to Henry Ford's lawyer and convinced him not to buy stock in Henry Ford's company because the horse is here to stay and the automobile is only a novelty. It won't last. He was a pessimist. He was wrong. In 1899, Charles Dull, director of the U.S. Patent Office, made the declaration that everything that can be invented has been invented. The pessimists are often wrong. Have you thought about the fact that pessimist people are not happy people? They're not happy because they can't be, since they're looking at the worst side of things. They can't be, since things are always bad, and they can't be happy, since any good at the moment will soon turn out bad. It won't last. You ever talk to somebody that's a pessimist and everything's dark and everything's dreary, and they see a moment of good, and you try to encourage them in that, and they downplay it because it's not going to last? Good never lasts. It always turns out bad. Optimists are happier people. How can I say that? Well, let's go back to Matthew chapter 5. Remember Matthew chapter 6? I tried to make this connection a moment ago, and if you didn't catch it, let's go back and make this connection again between Matthew 5 and chapter 6. This sermon is about people in my kingdom, is what Jesus is talking about. And it's interesting that he talked about worry in chapter 6. He tells them, in my kingdom, there is no need for worry. Put your faith and your trust and your confidence in God. That's his point in chapter 6. But this started on the note in Matthew chapter 5, blessed are the poor in spirit. We define blessed as being happy are those. Happy are those who mourn. Happy are those who are meek. Happy are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness. He is saying those in my kingdom are happy people. But those in my kingdom, chapter 6, are not filled with pessimism and worry. They put their faith and their trust and their confidence in God. There was a survey that was reported in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings in August of 2002. And their report suggested that the optimists, those who are optimistic, reported that they had fewer problems with work and daily activities. They had less pain and fewer limitations. They also had less interference from physical and emotional problems when engaging in social activities. And furthermore, that they had increased energy, and furthermore, they felt peaceful and happier and calmer because they had an optimistic outlook on life. Jesus taught us not to bar troubles from tomorrow. Let's go to Matthew chapter 6. The same context now in Matthew chapter 6. Remember we talked in verse 25 about don't worry about anything, but put your faith and your trust and your confidence in God. Now look at verse 34. He said, do not worry about tomorrow. For tomorrow will worry about the things of its own. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. See what Jesus is saying? Jesus said, don't borrow tomorrow's trouble. We have enough worries today. We have enough problems to wrestle with today. Don't take tomorrow's problems and worry about what if. And have that pessimistic outlook on life. Don't worry about tomorrow's trouble. I like this story about Abraham Lincoln and his companion when he was circuit riding as a lawyer. When they're out in a rural section of the country, And they were anticipating, and they had heard about this treacherous Fox River. They came upon a preacher who was a circuit rider. And they asked him if he knew anything about the condition of the river. And his answer was, "Oh yes, I know all about the Fox River. I've crossed it often, and I understand it well." But he said, "I have one simple rule with regard to the Fox River. I never cross it till I reach it." Do you have rivers that you're trying to cross that you hadn't even got to yet? Do you have rivers that you're trying to cross when you don't even know what the condition of the river is yet? Don't ever cross the river until you reach it. Don't bring tomorrow's trouble into today, and that'll really lead unto happiness. And here's another principle. Finally, let's talk about this principle. Put yesterday in the rearview mirror. Put yesterday in the rearview mirror. How so? Well, the past can become ball and chain that we drag around with us. We focus on our mistakes. We focus on our sins, how we've disappointed others, how we've broken rules, and things that we've done that are embarrassing. And what we wish is, we wish we could do something about that and go back and we could undo all of that. I wished I could go back and change it, you say. And if we are honest, everyone has to admit there's something in our past. Because all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. If you are the age of accountability, you've committed sin. If you're a Christian and you have been forgiven in the past, you'll commit sin again, 1 John 1 and in verse 8. So every one of us have something in our past that's embarrassing, that we've said wrong and that we've done wrong. We wish we could go back and undo. But here's what I want you to understand. God doesn't want us to wallow in self-hate and self-loathing. Let's turn to Philippians chapter 3. If you don't remember any other passage on this point, remember this one because we're going to notice it twice. Turn to Philippians chapter 3. This is interesting too because I keep coming back to Philippians. This is that same book that talks about joy and rejoicing and happiness in the Lord. Philippians chapter 3 and in verse 13, the Apostle Paul said, "The brethren, I count myself to have apprehended, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forth to those things which are before." We'll come back to that verse in a moment. Is it in the context of talking about things in his life, his past? And he said, "I've learned to do this. I've learned to forget the things which are behind, both good and bad. There are great accomplishments in the past. I can't live and relish in all of that. There are great sins in the past. I can't live with the embarrassment of all of that for my life." He said, "I've learned to put all those things behind me." God doesn't want you to wallow in your self-hate and self-pity because you've done great things in the past that are embarrassing. God doesn't want you to do that. Let's turn to another case in 2 Corinthians chapter 2. We'll come back to Philippians a little bit later. But turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. Now, as you're turning there, let me suggest to you that this is dealing with that fornicator at Corinth. Here was a man who had committed the sin of fornication. And this had gone on for a while, and they should have dealt with it, and they didn't. And finally, they did. And now we come to 2 Corinthians chapter 2. And Paul's point, beginning at verse 7, without reading all of these verses, let's notice verse 7, though, "So that on the contrary, you ought rather to forgive and comfort him." What they were doing at Corinth, as evidence in this context, was that they finally dealt with him, withdrew from him, but they kept telling him about his sin and applying the pressure for him to be embarrassed about what he had done that was wrong. And they're not letting up on him. And what Paul said is, it's time to move past all of that. Forgive him. And comfort him and welcome him and put it behind you and forget it and go on. I don't want him wallowing in the self-pity, and I don't want him to be hating and beating himself up because of that. Now he's forgiven. Let's move on. Hebrews chapter 12 talks about lifting up hands which hang down and knees that are feeble. In that discouragement, lift yourself up and go on and press forward, he said. Hebrews chapter 10 in verse 36 says we need patience to endure. Keep on pressing on. Don't give up. Don't dwell on your past. What I want to suggest to you is if God can put the wrongs in the past, then we can too. Do you realize Proverbs chapter 5 and verse 21 says God sees all of our wrongs almost parallel, at least it is in principle, to Hebrews chapter 4, but God sees all of our wrongs. They're all naked and open before him, and he knows every wrong we've done, which means he knows more than we know about ourselves. And yet, here's what God said. He was willing to forget all of the past and remember those against us no more. God said, I don't remember those anymore. I don't hold you accountable for those. In fact, 2 Corinthians chapter 7, apparently speaking about the same circumstance of chapter 2, God comforts the downcast. God lifts them up. And if God could do that, then the question is, can I not do that as well? Let's talk about Paul. He had a terrible past, and yet Paul moved on. Remember the fact that he persecuted Christians, Acts chapter 8, Acts chapter 9? Held the coats for those who stoned Stephen? He voiced his opinion they should be put to death, marched them off to prison. He was guilty of murder. And yet, let's turn to 1 Corinthians 15 and in verse 10. He talked about all of his past, and yet he focused on something instead of his past and all the wrong. He said, by the grace of God, I am what I am. Paul said, yeah, I've got a rough past, and I've done a lot in the past. In fact, I've done a lot of things. In fact, he said, I'm the chiefest of sinners. His point is, there's not anybody around who's any worse than what I was. Nobody did any worse than I did. But he said, by the grace of God, I am what I am. He focused on the grace of God, and then he put his past behind him. I said we'd come back to Philippians chapter 3. This is Paul talking about himself. I've learned to forget the things which are behind and reach forth to those things which are before. Again, I suggest that's in the context. Just earlier in that same chapter, he said, rejoice in the Lord. In the next chapter, he said, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. One of the keys to rejoicing, learn to put the past behind you. Here's the point. Learn to forgive yourself. Learn to put your trust and your confidence and your faith in God and put your past behind you. You say, I want to be happy. I want to be happy. What can I do? Here are five suggestions. You want to be happy? Conduct your life in harmony with the will of God. As long as you push it aside, as long as you ignore it, as long as you violate it, that leads to problems which cause unhappiness. You want to be happy? Conduct your life in harmony with the will of God. Secondly, lose yourself in service to God and others. Quit focusing on self and focus on others and focus on God. Thirdly, you want to be happy? Take pleasure in the simplest of things. Don't look for those big slices of happiness when there's little bits of happiness all around you. Fourthly, don't borrow tomorrow's troubles and worry about what if. You got enough problems for today. Don't worry about tomorrow. And then last of all, put yesterday in the rearview mirror. Forget the past. Move on. Trust in God and learn to be happy. There may be one more present who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge